This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 382 for June 16th of 2017. Can the Atlas lift Volkswagen? Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outofline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
All right, welcome everybody to another episode of Out of Line After Hours. Sitting here with my cohort and co-host, Gary Vasilash.
John, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
This is great. This is 2 weeks in a row. We have a giant vehicle in the studio.
That's exactly right.
So it's all good.
I like it when vehicles are in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Got to let everybody know Tom Murphy from Ward's Auto is joining us today.
And
Tom,
John,
good to have you on board.
Glad to be here.
But we've got to save most of our time for Michael Lovatti, who's here with us, along with a Volkswagen Atlas SUV. Volkswagen's really, I think, first real serious push into the segment. And Michael, it says here that you're vice president of product line mid and full size at Volkswagen Group of America. What's that mean exactly? What do you do?
Yeah, thanks, John. I'm glad to be here, Gary and Tom. I'm excited to be back in Detroit, too, for the afternoon. So the product line mid-full size means we're basically responsible for the project management, program management through the life cycle of the cars in the mid-full size segment. So in my case, Passat and the Atlas Now, which we're very excited about. And we maybe take the project through the whole life cycle from the very early phase of development to through start of production and then the model care and keeping it fresh through its life cycle. So,
and what I find interesting, you actually work in Chattanooga, mm-hmm. Tennessee, which is where this vehicle is,
yep.
is manufactured.
Yep.
So you're not at Volkswagen's American headquarters in Virginia, Herndon, right? So.
Very often.
Oh, very.
I'm in Herndon. Yes, quite a bit.
But you're where the yeah. you're very hands on with
yeah.
this project.
We're very much hands on. We're in the plant. Basically, all of 80% of the business units that we deal with are sitting in Chattanooga, and so it makes sense there. And I'm like I said, I'm very often in Herndon to work with the colleagues that are up there, responsible for the region, for the sales. And marketing of the product, so yeah. And
tell us about your involvement in the development of this vehicle. I mean, it's you're in Chattanooga, as yeah. you say, they build it there. What, you spent $900 million on getting the plant ready to build
right.
this thing, but
yeah.
you know, what's the genesis behind it?
Yeah, well, there's a lot. I mean, this goes back. This pre-exceeds even my involvement in the project. That's been going on. There's been always ideas about what to do in the SUV segment, the midsize SUV segment, which is obviously growing very strongly, and it's what the customer wants right now. And so there's been a lot of ideas about it and floating around. And really, in the past 3-4 years, it's really kicked off. And the team has, even before I got there, has been heavily involved in working with the engineers in the early phase to make sure that this thing is tailored then to the American customers and the tastes and how we drive cars here. And that was a pretty important contribution done from the region. Both in Chattanooga and the folks in Herndon. And now as we're into the launch phase, we're daily obviously involved in making sure that we're all prepped from the production standpoint, from the supply base standpoint, and getting it tweaked and ready to hit the market. So it's been a very collaborative effort the past years with our colleagues in Wolfsburg. We've really made a push to make this thing as American as possible, and that's primarily the contribution then from the team in Chattanooga and Herndon in the region, is to make sure that, we're going back and forth. Is this the right concept? Is this going to work? Is this adequate for the customer? And
so what's American about this versus what could be German about this? I mean,
yeah. Well, I think you guys, you said it when we opened up. This is great to have 2 weeks in a row such a large car. And this is the biggest car that we've made for the North American market. There's no question about it. It's really tailored, I think, to sort of the size understanding and space understanding that the customer has here. And if you sit in it and drive it, you feel it. I feel it when you feel how cavernous the space in the car is. And it's not something that's done primarily designed in Europe because the understanding of space is a little bit different. So that was one big push, is to make sure it covers that aspect. Then the functionality. Yeah, we are very, the way we use our products and what we do, we haul stuff, we have a lot of kids, we have family members that come in town, we take trips, we like to make sure we have space for that. That was another very big factor that went into the development of this, to make sure that we have that space and the usability. For example, the second seat row, making sure it's spacious enough and the functionality to get into the third row when the family's in town on the weekend. So those are pretty key aspects of the car that really went into it for this market.
Mm-hmm. I got to drive it a month ago in Texas. Really enjoyed it. I noticed all the storage that you're talking about, the huge central storage bin in the, you know, the center console, cubbies everywhere, mm-hmm. cup holders, lots of spacious cup holders. And yeah, that third row, it's really nice to have that extra, you know, that extra row, even though it might not get used that often. But in terms of the ride, I was trying to recall what it was like in the Touareg, but this to me felt a little bit softer mm-hmm. than riding the Touareg, which, you know, to the question about American versus German, I think a lot of Americans are less tuned to that kind of sports car like feel. They want something a little bit softer. Was that a significant goal in tuning this so that it was perhaps a bit softer while still feeling somewhat European?
No, I think it was an attempt to have a balance there. Because it just inherently, one of our emphasis is obviously on fun to drive. That's part of who we are as a brand, as a company globally. And we have that type of chassis and that drive aspect that's tuned to that. And we tried to maintain that as much as possible here in this vehicle as well. It is a little bit more dialed in for the customers here, but you do have the option then to select the drive mode, which then puts it right into the sport, to a more sporty, stiffer drive suspension than in the normal version. So, we were trying to find a balance, I would say, then for the customer. And if that customer wants to drive a little bit more stiff, the option is there with the drive select.
So that it's an American vehicle, but it's also got some Germanic characteristics
very
to it
much
in
so.
Terms of
yeah.
to differentiate it, because what this is up against the Pilot and the Highlander
and Explorer
and the Trevors,
yeah, right, mm-hmm. yeah. So we talk about size and functionality, which is tailored then for this market, but it has the VW genes and it has the European styling and the fun to drive still parts of it. If you look in it, I find classic interior. That's the European design. It is actually the first European SUV in this volume segment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's
a good point.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, that's a standout. Yeah, there's differences in the styling and the design, and that we were able to maintain here with this and offer the customers that first European styled SUV in the segment. Other than that, VW, the design of itself, pretty bold, in our opinion, with the size and then, you know, the stance on the road, the front with the lighting and the grille. And these are very VW-specific attributes.
Mm-hmm. Did you lead that effort of making sure that the American concerns were communicated effectively to Germany? Because they did make that point down at the drive last month that most of the work was done, you know, in Wolfsburg with a lot of American input. And I'm just curious, I mean, as they're deciding, no, we're not going to put that in, yes, we're going to put that in, what was it like trying to come to consensus, I guess, across the ocean in deciding what this Atlas was going to be like, how American it would be?
Yeah.
Were there battles that you had to fight through?
Yeah, it was a very cross-functional, collaborative effort, really, that went over years with various workshops, Klausuren, as we like to call them in Germany, where all these teams would come together, discuss certain agenda points about whether it's design or functions or specific features, and we would go through it. And there were certain characteristics that were then specified out of the region that said, hey, this is kind of what we need to tailor and make sure this is going to appeal to the American customer. And then, yeah, there were some times where it was back and forth because it was sort of a paradigm shift for some things. But in the end, the customer's interest in what is necessary here really took precedent and took the priority in that case. And like I said, it was at the end, it was pretty easy to find the consensus that we needed.
And, you know, one thing I'm curious about this vehicle, this is the MQB platform, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I had no idea that that kind of architecture, to use the industry parlance, had this much bandwidth. I mean, this is a gigantic vehicle, but you guys are doing golfs off the MQB too, right?
Yeah.
So could you give us a little bit of a flavor of what you're able to do with this architecture? And I'm especially curious from a cost standpoint, because presumably this is why Volkswagen went with it. Mm-hmm. The MQB architecture was a way of being able to hold down costs.
Yeah, that's a big advantage of a platform like that that finds its place then in so many different cars and globally. And the MQB is really a toolkit for us that, you know, with developed components that can easily be pieced together to quickly then make new vehicles. And this is a product or a result of that. And the platform allows that adaptability to take stampings, chassis, engine, powertrain, put it together with maybe some slight modifications without having to do a brand new development. And you can then find an SUV like this or put together an SUV like this out of that. So, and that's really the benefit of that platform. And in terms of cost, you're benefiting from development that has been done not just for one specific car, but for a multitude of vehicles around the world, less the few adaptations that are necessary.
And the Arteon will come off of that platform as well, the new flagship sedan?
Yeah. It's also based on MQB, basically. And so that's another thing. The Arteon, also a new vehicle in the portfolio, which has then allowed them to be put together relatively quickly and cost-effectively with an existing platform.
What's the powertrain for the Atlas?
We have two options. We have the four-cylinder turbo in a two-wheel drive configuration, and then the available...
What's the displacement of the four?
The two-liter.
Oh, two-liter.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Didn't hear that. Sorry.
Sorry, yeah. The two-liter four-cylinder. And then we have the optional, the VR6, with all-wheel drive.
Available. What do you think the split's going to be? What are you forecasting?
Tough to say. I think the mix that we have in the engine... we know that segment is right now a six-cylinder segment. I think there's with some of the technologies that are coming out there right now, we do see that the four-cylinder has starting to have more of a place there. There's no question about it.
Is there a big price gap between the two?
No, it's, yeah. I mean, it's...
A couple of grand for the V6.
$3,000, I believe it is. Based on the segment, we feel there's going to be a high share of the V6. There's no question about it. But both engines are, with the late availability of the 2-liter, will be out shortly. I think we've been able to cover the segment that and what the expectations are pretty well.
And you can only get the all-wheel drive with
the
V6.
That's correct.
So that's going to skew the number a bit.
Right.
In favor of the V6s in certain markets where all-wheel drive in that segment is...
Yeah.
Pretty important.
That's correct.
And then otherwise it's front drive.
Yes, otherwise it's front drive.
And what about the transmission?
It's an 8-speed automatic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So AQ transmission, 8-speed automatic. First time in this vehicle, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
It's a brand new one. So we're excited about it. It's very smooth.
Mm-hmm. Is that your transmission or did that come from ZF?
It's Izin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So do you have clever drive mode selection?
Yes, we do. We have drive mode selection where we have four available.
Snow standard. And mud. And
snow, mountain, sport, and normal. Yeah, comfort.
And this adjusts.
And then you can, and then the driver, the user is able then to configure as that individual driver sees fit for himself or herself. And there's very many personalization opportunities and capabilities here in this, not just in terms of the drive mode, but also infotainment, and that can all be saved in certain driver profiles. And so you can sit in the car, drive it, set it to driver, Gary, for example, and then your pre-selected configuration will pop up immediately.
Mm-hmm.
How you
and that's
drive.
Only with the all-wheel drive models?
Mm-hmm.
And it's all-time all-wheel drive, correct?
It's all-time all-wheel drive.
I think I heard they can send torque to one wheel, 100% of the torque to one wheel if that's the only wheel that has...
If it notices slippage, then we have in the gears the ability then to shift that power then to where it's needed at that particular moment in time, balance it out, and move forward.
Yeah. Do you see this as being an on-the-road vehicle, though, rather than a off-the-road vehicle?
I think the user... The customer is primarily on the road. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. But this is capable, very capable, of going off-road should the need be there. There's no question about it. We've tested it ourselves and driven it. There's features in the vehicle that would support the customer in that case in an off-road setting. And I think should there be a need, and there are some adventurous drivers out there, they won't have a problem with it.
Did you do any study to figure out in that segment of three-row utility vehicles, what's the percentage of buyers who actually tow something? In which case, that would make the V6 more attractive. But mm-hmm. Was that something that you were dialed into to find out, okay, if we want to sell more of these things, there's a lot of Americans who tow stuff up north or wherever,
right.
Boats, campers, small campers.
Yeah.
And was that, what kind of split is there in that segment?
Yeah, a very important contributor to how this car is going to be used and then how we were to develop it and tailor it for this market. We know in this segment the customers are using it for functionality. They have a certain lifestyle. That's how we live here in America, and we need to tow stuff around and have that ability to. And so that was very much considered in the development, and it's an option that's available, and we feel that it will be used strongly because this vehicle and our offering in the segment, I think the customers are going to need it and want to have it now.
Is this car available in other markets, or is this just an American vehicle?
No, it will be available in other markets, obviously in the North American region, Canada, Mexico. And from here, Chattanooga will also be exporting. Yeah.
So will you be able to get an Atlas in Germany?
No.
In West Europe, but in
Russia.
Did you hear Russia will be will get it?
Arabic Gulf states.
And parts of the Middle East?
Yeah, Arabic Gulf states, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And because Western Europe deemed it too large for the region?
It definitely is a vehicle more tailored to this market here. We're always discussing what we could do with it to generate additional markets right now. Right now the plan is Russia and then AGCC, and we'll see how it develops from there.
But what does that acronym stand for?
The Arabian Gulf States, yeah.
Okay, we've got some questions coming in from viewers here. Our Work wants to know, will it fit a 4x8 sheet of plywood?
Well, we have to, I haven't tried it with a 4x8 plywood, but I would give it a good bet. We've got 96 cubic feet of room in the back, so we'd have to give it a shot. But it's.
But when the
there's a selling row, point. Yeah. You got to measure it.
Right. When the second row seats are flat and the third row seats are flat, I'm trying to recall it. You have a full flat load floor?
It's a flat surface.
We're not seeing the second row.
The benefits of this concept is it will all lay flat. So you have no lip. You have nothing that you're going to have to lift anything up around.
So then the question is whether you've got 4 feet across the...
Well.
I don't think that it's going to be...
It may not fit flat, but it'll fit.
You're going to find a way to wiggle it in there, and this vehicle will give you a good opportunity to do that.
Yeah. Okay, Zuma Films wants to know, any hybrid powertrains coming for the Atlas?
Well, it's a discussion.
Nobody else has got one right now. Not in this segment, right?
Yeah, right. We feel right now...
Is there a Highlander hybrid?
Oh, is there a Highlander?
I'm pretty sure there is.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There is.
No, we feel with the mix of engines that we're offering right now with the 4-cylinder, 6-cylinder, we've got the segment pretty well covered. And we'll see how the segment continues to develop in the future. But right now we're confident with the offering we have.
Okay, Armin says, I got to believe the diesel scandal messed up the engine lineup for the Atlas. Are you looking to offer other options in the future other than what's available today? You hinted at that with the hybrid that you're talking about it.
And you're always analyzing, seeing what the competition is doing, where the market trends are going. Right now with this the midsize SUV segment, the 4-cylinder, the 6-cylinder with the combination front wheel, all-wheel drive, configuration that we've put together for this, and that's the plan for now.
Mm-hmm. Had you considered a diesel at any point for the vehicle? It almost seemed ideal for something like this.
We've said the diesel is right now we're not going to offer it anymore here in the U.S. market, and so the four.
But years ago, when the vehicle was in development, it could have been a serious selling point. Basically an advantage over the competition because really nobody else was putting a diesel in that segment, and it would really, a 2-liter turbo diesel in a vehicle that size would be great.
that could have been. But the analysis that we've done, and really we've looked at just about everything we can, I think the four-cylinder, the six-cylinder right now is where we're going to go.
When I was driving the six-cylinder on the launch last month, it was getting like 24 miles per gallon in a three-row vehicle with a fair amount of cargo. Well, not a ton of cargo, but it was... I was pretty impressed with that number.
And you drive like a maniac. Huh?
I've
driven with them. Trust me on this.
Yeah, so, okay.
Yeah, I just...
I wasn't pushing it that hard.
Yeah.
No. The 2-liter was not available, so I haven't driven the 2-liter.
You'd have broken it anyway.
So we haven't talked pricing, just for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Run us through, you know, not every single trim line and everything like that, but how low a price can you buy it for and how much can you load it up to?
Yeah, right. Well, what we've announced and is now available at the lots is the special launch model, $33,500. With the V6 front-wheel drive. And we have a trim range up to, right now, the SEL premium, about starting at about 48,000. So, and then with the entry, the 2-liter, with the later availability, will be at 30,500, mm-hmm. with various trims then there on up.
Mm-hmm. So that would be the lowest price, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So and we really wanted to go at the sweet spot of the segment, and that's what I think we've been able to accomplish with this vehicle.
How's it doing in the marketplace right now? Some of the advertising on it's gotten a lot of attention, positive attention, yeah. as a matter of fact.
Yeah, we've pushed it out there into the market. There's no question it's out there. In the first few weeks, and month ending May, 1,600 units. I think now we're up to around 2,300 units. So the feedback so far is very positive, and we're excited to see where it goes from here.
And I'm sorry, the 4 will be available when? In 2 months still?
Yeah, roundabout, yeah.
All right.
So you guys offer something called automatic post-collision braking as a standard.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
It's, an accident is a series of events. It could be, or we assume that it's going to be a series of events. So if the airbag sensors then trigger due to a collision, then the automatic braking, the braking sets in automatically to then, in that case, if there's no chance to press the brake or something that happens autonomously to prevent then further collision from there on out. Hmm. So it's
like a secondary braking.
Yeah, exactly.
After.
Yeah, so if collision happens, airbag sensor heads off, and that says, oh, hey, we have to trigger this braking to prevent any further collision going forward.
I've never heard that term, post-collision braking.
Yeah.
Does anyone else do that?
No, as far as I know.
This is a first.
This is as far as I'm aware of right now, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Audi doesn't have it either?
I'm not sure.
So nowadays, you know, you can have the coolest looking, best performing vehicle, but mm-hmm. people are going to say, okay, but what about the technology that you have for infotainment? So what do you guys have on offer in the Atlas?
Yeah, we have two offerings. We have the S trim, the 6.5-inch MIB infotainment screen. And then in the higher trims, we have the 8-inch screen MIB as well. Apple, Android CarPlay, or the App Connect. So the Android Car, Apple CarPlay, Mirror Link is available as well. And then, obviously, one of the highlights that of this vehicle in particular is the introduction of the digital cockpit available on the SEL Premium.
And explain what that is.
Yeah, this is a fully digital cockpit. We all are very aware of how our cockpit looks mechanically with a mix of digital. This is fully digital configurable, so you can have different settings. You can have
so your speedometer is virtual, and your tachometer is virtual.
It's all virtual, and it's configurable.
In front of the steering wheel, that whole window.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's a very neat feature in line with the consumer technology expectations today. It's configurable. You can have your map and your navigation directly in front of your line of sight as the driver in this case. And it's a feature we think is really going to do well mm-hmm. in the market. And like I said, very much in line with consumer technology these days. Mm-hmm.
So Audi had it first. And is that dimension, is it 12.3 inches or 12? 12
inches? Yeah.
And is that dimension the same as in the Atlas then?
I don't have the direct comparison with Audi, but it's very much similar, the concept. I have to look again at the dimensions. I forget the off the top of my head. Yeah.
Do you know which? So you can do all sorts of things. You can have the map right in front of you, showing, you know, your your navigation directions can have you, you know, and then you can zoom in as much as you want. And then you can make the gauges on either side, the tach and the speedometer, either large and dominant or kind of pushed off further so you see even more map if you want.
Yeah.
And it's and then the color is just amazing. It's very high resolution, crisp graphics, and then you can switch that out if you want. Instead, your music options and
there's music options you can
phone
see. The phone, car settings, so you can toggle through consumption, how much fuel you have left to the next stop, the speeds, basic vehicle information. And it's all configurable in multiple settings, configuration, preset configuration. So,
do you have a sense for how American customers are likely to configure it most likely? Or what do you think their favorite view is going to be? Do they want to see that giant map, or do they want to have their radio options instead?
Tough to call. I can only say based on the way I've been driving so far, I like to have the map right there, and not so I'm not constantly looking over at the screen. You have it there. You have digitally how the speed, and then you can also see how much gas you have left to get you to the next gas station, and that's kind of basically the setting I've had in there. It's hard to say how that's going to lend itself then to the rest of the customers. But I do think that the map will be, and right in front of your sight of vision, is going to be probably a setting that's going to be used.
So when you're developing this in Germany and you said, you know, we need to have Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, did your German colleagues say, what are you talking about? I mean, this is an automobile. Why are you worried about Apple?
No, I don't know. We live in a consumer tech environment now. The customers have their phones everywhere, and that's basically where the information is that they need. That's how their music is, and so it makes sense to be able to integrate that as best as possible. So no, it wasn't, because it's a feature that the customers are very much coming to expect in this market as well, and it has its benefits. So,
and they probably recognize it as a safety feature if people are prone to load their phone Bluetooth into the system.
Right.
Then, if a call comes in or they have to make a call, it's so much you can just push a button and give a voice command.
Absolutely.
You're not fiddling with a hand and with a hand device.
Right. The buttons are scaled to dimension, so it's much easier to touch the screen. Then you're not looking for your phone and getting distracted then from the drive, which you're there to do.
Yeah.
I'd like to wrap up the segment going back to the styling of the vehicle. Because you've got very long horizontal lines, both inside and out, and you've got this very unusual or certainly different character line that almost sort of accentuates both the wheel wells with, you know, a strong character line connecting them. Tell me a little bit about some of the thinking that went into going with these specific attributes in the styling.
Yeah, wanted to make a bold approach. This Atlas and its size was there for this customer to demonstrate how bold and the size that it is. And this line here really adds to that, the flared wheel arches, and it really shows its presence on the road. And that's basically what was behind that.
So the crease on that door, I got to believe that the guys in the stamping plant are going, geez, you crazy?
Yeah, they're very proud of it.
Now they are, right?
Yeah.
Now that they figured out how to do it. Well, real good. We're going to have to wrap this up right now. But Michael Lavati, thanks so much for coming in and spending some time with us and showing us this new Atlas. Tom's driven it. Have you driven it?
No, I haven't
driven it either. I'm dying to get in this thing, and I know it's on my schedule to do so.
Yeah.
But it's great to see Volkswagen getting back on its feet again, as it were, and especially getting a vehicle designed specifically for the U.S. market.
Yeah.
And I think you guys are going to do terrifically with it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're excited about it. Please get into it. Get it out there. We're excited to be here today to talk about it. Thank you for the opportunity.
And also the Tiguan. Don't forget that.
Yeah.
And Tiguan
right
as well. That's
corner.
Exactly right.
That's right.
Okay. We're going to be coming right back in a moment, but first we're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history,
including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. Well, that was fun talking about the Atlas. But, yeah. And this is usually the time when we have Dr. Data come, but...
We still have Dr. Data coming. But here's... So there's no guessing involved. This is... But I think this is a very fascinating statistic that I found that it just doesn't seem likely to me, that the fastest growing city for electric vehicles, it's grown 78% from 2016 to 2017, is Kansas City.
Kansas City.
Well, they probably started at zero, right?
No, they're actually, and it's actually a fairly high number, and they have them ranked against Kansas City, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Denver, Raleigh, Durham, Miami, and Detroit. Hmm. And there's Kansas City's up there.
Why?
Well, part of the thing is that apparently there is something called the KCP&L Clean Charge Network that they started in 2015. And so basically they're putting up 1,000 public charging stations. 95% of them are installed right now. And the network is offering free charging.
Free works for me.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, but doesn't it sort of seem strange? Like, of all the places, well, if I would have said, if I would have named those other cities, right?
I would have never said Kansas City, right?
What do you think?
So the demand is driven by the supply. I mean, you've got the fuel for free. So,
why not?
It's encouraging people to think twice about, maybe I could make do with an electric vehicle.
And they're also saying that one of the things is because they're going to have such a density, across the metro region of charging stations, that people won't have range anxiety because they're fairly confident that there'll be a charging station that'll be available to them.
I give Kansas City a lot of credit. I mean, that's forward thinking. Somebody at that power company had to argue for that pretty heavily, I'm sure. It's not easy to sell that idea.
Well, free won't last forever.
Right. Well, they get them in, and then the prices start rolling in.
Yeah, but then they'll go back to gasoline if it's too much.
Yeah,
I'm not so sure about that.
Well, I'm not so sure about that either.
And also, I wonder what's the source of their electricity? Are they, is it mostly coal-fired plants down in Kansas City, or have they moved to more solar or wind or,
There's your assignment for next week, Dr. Data.
Yeah.
Where's their electricity coming from?
Nuclear? I don't know.
There's... burning the worst stuff they can possibly find to make those generator plants run.
Okay, Gary, you had a number of topics you wanted to get into.
So one of the things that I know that you were very fascinated in, so Saturday will be Sergio Marchionne's 65th birthday.
Yeah, and usually it's 65 and out.
Although, didn't he announce that he was going to be leaving at the end of 2018?
Correct.
So he's got some time. But so now the betting begins in terms of who might be his replacement. So
there's
like Mike Manley, who is the current CEO of Jeep, and Reid Bigland, who's been on After Hours with when we did the show on the Alpha Julia. Mm-hmm. So he runs Alpha, and I believe he runs U.S. sales. Richard Palmer, their CFO.
Altavilla?
Yeah.
And
Altavilla, who runs FCA Europe.
And one name that you think is a possibility.
Well, I threw it out. I mean, how could you not consider Mark Fields? Because, look, in his career, Fields worked in South America. He ran Mazda. He ran Ford of Europe. He ran the Premier Automotive Group. He ran North America. He became CEO. That's more than anybody else at FCA has ever done. And then I'm not disparaging FCA's bench. They got a pretty good bench. But... And the other point that I make is it was almost 40 years ago that the Ford Motor Company fired Lee Iacocca, who drove across town and started work at Chrysler.
Highland Park was closer to Dearborn, though, than Auburn Hills is.
This is true, but Lee was the guy who got Auburn Hills built. And, he had a chip on his shoulder after Ford fired him. He had something to prove. And I think Mark Fields probably has a chip on his shoulder and has something to prove. So my thinking is, I'm not predicting that they're going to go with him. I'm just saying, if I'm a board member at FCA, don't you have to put him on the list for consideration? So I'm throwing that out there.
What do you think,
Compelling
Tom?
Stuff.
Do you think Fields is...
I didn't think of it until 5 minutes ago. But yeah, I think that's not a bad idea. The story that I read recently said that they were most likely to hire from internally, which I think is smart. But, I mean, it didn't hurt Ford at all when they went outside and hired Mullally. So going outside maybe wouldn't be a bad thing. The parallel to Iacocca, though, is classic.
Okay, but here's my question. Okay, why would Mark want to do that? I mean, because, you know, FCA is you know, it's not doing well. I mean, I don't know, you know, a nicer way of saying that.
Think of the condition that Ford was in when he took it over from Mullally. So he's got more work to do if he were to take this job at FCA.
All right, so the question is
which is
the work but is the work that needs to be done even doable is what I'm sort of wondering about. Okay, I mean, because look, you know, Chrysler brand, what cars do they have?
300.
They're down to the Pacifica essentially, and the 300.
Yeah. Right, and then we've got Dodge with basically muscle cars, right? Challenge. Ram is doing fine, and Jeep is doing fine, but you know, so and then Fiat's not doing fine.
Not in the U.S. market.
Not in the U.S. market, but
it's doing okay in Europe, though. It's starting to look healthy again in Europe. Fiat is,
and I think that Alfa Giulia is a fine automobile.
Oh, I don't disagree. I think it's a wonderful car. But I mean, but my point is that there. I mean, it's like, would someone take that on, like Mark, who has basically been to the top of the mountain, as it were? And then to come back down to the bottom and see if he can build it back up. Because, I mean, he's, what, 56 years old?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I mean, look, when you're in that position and they tell you, hey, it's time for you to leave, I mean, nobody likes that. That's why I say I think he's got something to prove. But the issues you raise, Gary, are really good ones. Yeah, how secure is FCA's future? You know, here's a company that is, to your point, largely living on SUVs, pickups, and that, you know, Rams and Jeeps is what's keeping that company alive right now. And would a Mark Fields go, you know, I'd love to get back in the industry, but I'm not sure I want to do it with that company. I have no idea. All I'm saying is that if the board is trying to figure out and doing its fiduciary duty of the best thing for the shareholders, I don't see how they cannot at least put his name on the list and pay him a phone call or a visit.
And then the question is, could he be more successful than Sergio has been in terms of brokering a deal with the potential nether automaker?
Could be. I mean, you know, look, we're being brutally honest. Sergio's not liked in a lot of circles. And when deals get made, sometimes personalities count for things. And so who knows? Maybe a Fields would be more amenable to somebody that's considering buying the company or not.
We'll see.
We'll see. Yes. What else?
So speaking of FCA, and we were talking about diesels before, that report came out that West Virginia University seems to have found that there's a little bit more exhaust coming out of those FCA diesels than one had thought there would have been.
Yeah, well, these are the guys, of course, that, you know, really discovered the Volkswagen cheating because they were doing on-the-road testing. And we know that the EPA will allow you to exceed emission standards under certain operating conditions, but only for a brief amount of time. And what these guys seem to be saying, I haven't read the full report, but it does not look good for FCA. They're claiming up to 20 times. 25 times? Jeez. So, this might be the smoking gun.
Except that aren't they saying, though, that they don't see evidence that there was actual software tampering, defeat devices, you know, baked into the process, which is different. I mean, I'm not excusing what they've done.
I'm not sure about that, Tom, because I thought, based on the very little that I read, is that West Virginia University found that it behaved very differently when it thought it was being tested versus them just driving it out on the open road.
Yeah.
I don't think they put it on chassis dynos, right?
No,
but they simulated a test.
Then another bad news for diesels, apparently the mayor of Munich is thinking about banning diesels from the city center. And
I think every big city mayor around the planet is.
Well, but I mean, it's sort of ironic that you know you have Munich, home of BMW, and the mayor of Stuttgart, home of Mercedes and Porsche, is also talking about banning diesels. And they're saying that one of the knock-on problems of this is the fact that it's having an effect on used car values in Germany, because basically loans apparently there are predicated on the value. I mean, just almost like a leasing sort of a situation. Mm-hmm. And so if you have lots of diesel cars coming in that have very little value or decreased mm-hmm. value. But, I mean, doesn't it seem very strange that, you know, we're hearing, I mean, well, we haven't heard Chicago, we haven't heard New York, we haven't heard Los Angeles, we haven't heard San
Francisco. That's because they don't have the same problem with diesels that they have
right.
in the big European cities where half the market is diesel cars.
But, I mean,
here in the U.S.,
I can see
it's
Paris,
fairly
I can
minuscule.
See Madrid, but, you know, when you got the, you know, hardcore
Look,
German companies.
You're right. It's kind of a shock to see it. But, you know, ostensibly or reportedly, Munich's did a sample of its air quality and went, holy moly,
yeah.
We got real high levels of NOx and PM 2.5, and we just got to ban these things. But this comes back to Europe having this fig leaf of emission standards, which are, as we've talked about on the show a whole lot, look tough on paper, but are not tough whatsoever because of the way that they test them and because of the loopholes that they allow. Had they had, and you know, I know I'm going to sound like some American telling Europe what it should do, but had they had emission standards that really stood for something, I don't think they'd be running into the problem that they do right now of having these very high NOx and PM 2.5 levels.
Or if they just installed more free charging stations, they'd have very little problem whatsoever.
So I don't
know.
They've
got to follow the lead of Kansas City.
They burn a lot of coal in Germany. Mm-hmm. So your electric car may not be a whole lot of an improvement.
But there's more nuclear energy also in Europe. I mean, especially
France. None
not,
in Germany.
Not so much
They're
in
shutting everything down.
Right.
Or have already.
Yeah. So on another topic, months and months and months ago, we talked about Project Titan, the Apple initiative, and then a few months after that, we talked about maybe there's going to be no Project Titan.
Well, they laid off a bunch of automotive engineers.
Right. And now we hear Tim Cook talk to Bloomberg this week and basically, or last week after the developers conference, and basically indicated that they're working on AI, and he sees autonomous vehicles as being a big part of this. And so he's saying, you know, you're having, you know, ride sharing and car hailing, you're having electric vehicles, and you're having the move towards autonomy. So here's the question to you guys. Does Apple just end up coming up with a product that they sell to Volkswagen or Ford or FCA or whomever, or do they partner with somebody and come up with what is ostensibly an Apple vehicle?
I don't think Volkswagen or any automaker wants to buy a car from Apple and turn around and sell it. I mean, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I think partnerships would be more likely, in my opinion.
But, I mean, partnership how? I mean, it'd be like
in terms of the, you know, the expertise in AI.
But would they just sell it like, you know, if you know, Eisen or ZF making transmissions?
Similar.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think they're going to design their own car and contract it out and use it in a ride-sharing service that may not start out as autonomous but probably would. And I think they want to get into the mobility space. In fact, there's rumors in town, it's more than rumors, that they've put out RFQs for componentry on cars. I'm talking like chassis-level stuff, not electronic stuff. Mm. So
who would build? Would it be like a Magna Steyr build this thing, or would it be, I don't know, let's say a local car company based in Auburn Hills that may have some excess capacity?
Well, Sergio's already indicated he'd be very interested in building a car for
right.
somebody. Now, this goes back a couple of years ago. I don't know where that stands right now. But, yeah, look, if you think that the U.S. market is starting to go down a bit, there's going to be a lot of excess capacity. If you think that all this mobility services thing in another decade and a half or so is really going to reduce car sales, there's going to be even more excess capacity. I think Apple could probably find a lot of willing manufacturers to make its car.
So then in that scenario, whose brand name would be on that car?
Apple.
If it's contract assembled, it's
well, you don't see Foxconn's, you know, logo on any Apple product whatsoever, even though they build all of Apple's products. You know, Apple has mastered the way of designing everything in-house and contract manufacturing everything else. So they control the brand, the marketing, the packaging, but Foxconn does all their manufacturing. And so I would expect them to follow that same kind of model with a car.
Okay, so let me ask you sort of a follow-on question to that. So if when Apple comes out with, say, a new iPhone, and if you go online and you look at the Apple site, that there will invariably be a video that Johnny Ives, who's head of design for Apple, and he'll be talking about a radius on the phone or a chamfer on the phone, and he'll actually show them milling this and, you know, very, very detailed into how this thing is manufactured, right? As you say, they don't do any manufacturing, but, you know, they are designing it with manufacturing in mind. Okay, so the question is there a manufacturer that Apple would feel more confident in terms of building their car than somebody who just happened to have a whole lot of capacity?
You mean like Tesla or something?
Well, they don't have a whole lot of capacity. They got problems of their own. But I'm just saying that, okay, so at the end of the day, you know, let's say, you know, I don't know, would Apple want somebody to know that Ford built their car, or they want to, you know, that Chevy built their car?
That's what I'm saying. If they, I mean, they probably would be okay. I mean, they might want to be associated with Tesla than with an old school car manufacturer
that's been in business
for 110 years.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure that it would matter really because, you know, there was a big question when Honda started building cars in the United States, first foreign automaker to build cars in the U.S. in the modern era. And there was a big question, would Americans buy a Japanese-branded car built by America? It didn't matter at all. Volkswagen and Mercedes sweated the same thing when they put plants in the U.S. Would people really buy an American-made BMW or Mercedes? Nobody even knows about it. Buick bringing in a Chinese-assembled Envision. The public doesn't know this stuff and doesn't care.
But that's because you're talking about cars that are good cars that are, you know, regardless of who made them, you know that it's going to start when you turn the key. You know that it's going to get you down the road reliably. How much faith do we really want to put in Apple actually making a car without the assistance of an automaker that has a lot of experience?
See, I think for a lot of people that would be an advantage.
Would it?
Yeah. Because it's from Apple.
I would.
Because they're like fail-safe, right? I mean, it's no blue screen of death like there was with Microsoft.
When my phone dies, you know, I don't really sweat the details.
Oh, does your phone die?
All the time, actually. It's flickering. Actually, it's an Android phone.
Well, there you go.
But my wife's
iPhone. Because Android was free. So some handset maker said, oh, this free stuff.
My wife's iPhone just stopped charging the other day. Just willy-nilly. It's like, okay, it's an inconvenience. It's not a matter of life and death on the highway.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
See, I think so. So this week also happens to be the week that the Google car, which I did not know until this week, was called Firefly, the bubble car, right? The Google car, built, as we discovered, by Roush.
In Livonia, Michigan.
Now, the Waymo car.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so the little round, cute thing. Now, it seems to me that if I were sitting in Cupertino, I would say, I want somebody like that to be building.
I'll bet
cars.
He'd jump at the opportunity.
But I mean, because you know, then you're able to say, you know, we have this specialist manufacturer that is making our cars specially versus, yeah, you know what? They're running Chevy Sparks down that line and they're running our cars down the one right next to it. That's what I think.
No,
you disagree, I can tell.
No, I think you're on the right track.
Well, you guys can continue to disagree. That's fine. But we got to take a quick commercial break right now. We're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. And Gary's got more topics for us.
All right,
to discuss.
So Sort of in line with what we've been talking about here and in terms of manufacturing stuff. So this week at the General Motors Lake Orion assembly plant, they announced that they had manufactured 130 Bolt EV autonomous vehicles. So it'd be Bolt EV AV in my parlance.
Okay.
So, you know, they're sort of making a big deal out of the fact that, you know what, you know, not only do we have autonomous vehicles, but you know what, we have a factory. We have the wherewithal to build these things. So seriously, is that an advantage for General Motors or is that PR?
It's a little of both, I think. I mean, comparing to Apple, you know, when is Apple going to roll a car out of their plant? You know, you don't just snap your fingers and have a car that is safe to be driven on the highway at 65 or 70 miles an hour. So I give them credit.
You're nervous about cars.
I give them credit for doing that. I mean, they have this fine plant in Lake Orion, Michigan that is churning out Bolts. And, you know, the fact that it's electric, that gets more than 200 miles per range, plus has the ability to run in autonomous mode. And keep in mind, these are only test vehicles that they've built
that are
going into certain fleets in certain cities around the country. And those 100 vehicles, I think, joined another group of 50 or so.
So they have 180 now. It's 130 plus 50.
Yeah, which, you know, hey.
Okay, but I'm Ford. So I'm Ford, and I'm saying, you know what? I'm building Fusions, and what I'm just simply doing is that I'm taking them to a facility in Dearborn, and I'm adding the LiDAR systems, and I'm adding the electronic systems, and zoom, there they go.
Well, the question is, getting to your point, how did GM build these cars? Did they take them offline, gut them, put stuff in, and then say, hey, we built these bolts in the plant?
Or did they flow it in through the system?
Or was it sequenced in line so that you're actually not pulling them offline and doing special operations? If they're doing it in line, then I think it's more than PR. I think that could be important.
But don't you sort of think that whether you're building cars that have autonomous capabilities or whether you're building cars that have special normal functions, that you might have a spur line that goes off the main line and you do some other stuff to it? And so my point is that if you're building Fusions and you're just building them, right, and then you take them somewhere else, and then you say, well, you know, we got to remove this section of the IP, and then we're going to put this other part in there, and then we're going to put these things on the top of the thing. I don't see how that's any different than what General Motors is doing.
Well, I think...
Because all cars have to be built, you know, so all non-purpose-built cars, right, are being built on the line. And they got to add this stuff.
But we're only talking 100 vehicles. It's not like it's part of the weekly batch that they're building, you know, and it's not 10,000 Silverados.
Is it publicity?
Of course it is. And what else can they do to appeal to Wall Street? I mean, isn't this what they need to do to try to create value for the shareholders? I mean, they can put the finest Corvette on the road and the finest Silverado, and they can do well with the new Malibu, but no one's really paying attention on Wall Street. So people are interested in new technology. And so I give them credit for it. Maybe one of your viewers can chime in and tell us exactly how are they outfitting those 100, or how did they outfit those 100 vehicles? Is it on the main line, or is it a spur? Or?
Well, you know, a spur line's fine. What I'm getting at is if all they're doing is building these complete vehicles, driving them off the line and now having to take part of the interior part or pull the bumpers off to put sensors, then it's just a bunch of PR. But if they're actually, even if it is a spur line, but they're going down the main line, you're learning stuff from a tack time standpoint, you know, from a sequencing standpoint.
It's tooling for the future.
And so there's some good lessons. But to your point, Tom, you're right. If you can go to Wall Street and say, look, we can run these suckers down the line, and there's nobody else in the world doing that right now. That should count for something.
Absolutely.
If that's the way they're doing it.
You're skeptical.
I'm skeptical.
Okay.
To the point of tack time. So tack time, as you remember from your guide to the Toyota production system, is actually based on consumer pull. Okay, which is different than cycle time, which is basically how long it takes you to do something.
Right.
So obviously there is very little in the way of consumer pull.
Well, there's zero consumer pull because these are not going to consumers.
To build 130 cars, which basically if we have, you know, that would take like 2 hours and 5 minutes of normal production time, right?
Yeah,
with,
right.
You know, 60 units an hour. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, what else you got?
All right. So Akio Toyota, this is all autonomy all the time, I think. So Akio Toyota said this week that in order for them to, and this was to their annual meeting, that for Toyota to get further advanced in high technology, they would be open to partnerships or
acquisitions. Yeah.
Maybe they'll buy Apple.
Or Apple buys them.
I wonder who has more money.
That's a good question, because Toyota does have a lot of cash. No, Apple's got way more cash than Toyota. I haven't looked in a while. Last time I looked, Toyota was sitting on about $35 billion in cash.
Wow.
And what's the number
sort of
for
like
Apple?
What you got, right?
It's like half that.
Yeah. And Apple's got several hundred billion in cash. So, but, you know, this is very interesting, because Japanese automakers don't buy other car companies. They don't buy other companies, period. You know, if you go way back early, you know, half a century ago, that might have been the case. But they believe in rolling their own. They believe in organic internal growth. And so for him to come out and say, hey, we're ready to do acquisitions, joint ventures, mergers, whatever, that shows a real fundamental change of thinking at Toyota.
And you know, the thing that is I find to be striking about this, though, is that basically, you know, Toyota has you know, is spending, what is it, $5 billion on its you know, for the next five, you know, $1 billion a year for the next 5 years to develop autonomy. And he's like saying, we need more. We're behind the eight ball. I mean, how could this possibly be?
Well, I didn't believe in autonomous cars until I heard John McElroy talking passionately about them. I was hearing these stories about autonomous vehicles.
You thought they were unicorns?
Ridiculous. And John laid it out there, and he turned me into a believer. I mean, not that I'm eager to put my life in the hands of a self-driving car, but so I've been thinking a lot more seriously about it after John, you know, showed me through why this makes sense. And
I'll give you his autograph.
So
after
that,
the show.
that I mean, to your point about investment, it's going to be crazy expensive to get this stuff off the ground. So I wouldn't be surprised if Toyota feels like, yeah, we need to spend more money on this.
Well, look, Toyota's got to play catch up. They're behind the eight ball. You know, 2 years ago, they were poo-pooing the whole thing, saying they were never going to do an autonomous car. They believed in driver assist, but not in taking the driver out of the equation altogether. And the fact that they formed an artificial intelligence research group in the United States, not in Japan, you know, that was a clear sign of a change of thinking at Toyota. They're behind GM and Ford, and definitely behind Waymo and some of the others. They know they've got to catch up right now, and this is, you know, reflective of what's going on, the fact that they do these JVs or acquisitions.
So who might they acquire? I mean, would it be some small company that we've never heard of before,
yes,
like when General Motors bought Cruise Automation?
Exactly.
It's like,
exactly.
Cruise Automation. I mean, only you knew who they were.
No, I didn't.
I'm sure you did.
But, yeah, no, that's who they're going to go after. The race is on for talent. And there aren't a whole lot of people out there that have got autonomous vehicle development experience. The ones that were out there have all been snapped up. You know, a key reason why GM bought Cruise Automation was just to get the people that were there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Toyota's going to have to do the same thing.
So do we see, as, you know, everybody's talking 2020, 2021, I mean, with, you know, which isn't that far away from now.
No.
I mean,
it's designed or automotive terms, it's, you know,
it's right around the corner.
It's like tomorrow. Yeah.
Right. They're already working on those cars.
Yeah.
So do you sort of think it's going to be, you know, like one company will come out and it'll have autonomous vehicles and then others will follow in months or years, or that there'll be a whole bunch?
Like they're all there just overnight.
Or you know, I mean, several versus, you know. Just
well, look, the stuff that's coming out in 2020 or 2021 are not going to be in dealerships. Now, Tesla might be different. Tesla says they're going to have fully autonomous. So set them aside for the moment. Amongst the traditional automakers, you know, what Ford or BMW or even Mercedes are talking about is having autonomous cars in ride-sharing services in geo-fenced areas in high population density areas, you know, the San Franciscos and whatnot of the world.
It's not taking you from Detroit to Chicago.
No, no. It'll be in a geo-fenced area. And, you know, as the analogy has been drawn before, it's like when cell phones came out. You could only use them in certain downtown areas where the cells existed. You couldn't put them in your car and drive out and use them on the freeway. You couldn't use them at the airport until those cell towers got built. And so it took not a whole lot of time, but it was about a decade of building this out to where you can take your cell phone almost anywhere now and have it used. That's how it's going to roll out with autonomy. It's going to start out in these little geofenced areas, and over the course of a decade or so, those geofence posts are going to be moved farther and farther apart.
My issue with autonomous vehicles, though, is every time I'm in a traffic jam here in Metro Detroit, I'm looking around at all the cars and I'm seeing one person per vehicle, including me. You know, so there's a certain bit of guilt there of, you know, okay, could I have planned this better? Should I be sharing a ride? Should I be carpooling? And I'm thinking, in autonomous cars, if we're still one person per vehicle, we haven't really solved anything. So you probably saw the news about BMW with this bus manufacturer, electric bus maker.
Proterra.
Which I find interesting. And I'm starting to think more like we have very little public transportation here in Metro Detroit. I live right off Woodward, so I could if I work downtown Detroit, I could very easily walk from my house, hop a bus near 13 Mile and Woodward and go straight downtown. And if I worked at General Motors or some other place, it would be very convenient. But, you know, most of us just don't have that flexibility with our, you know, so we have to go everywhere. We got to go to the grocery store or whatever. And I'm really thinking, you know, there should be more of this ride sharing. I mean, if we want to make our lives better on the highways and get rid of some of the traffic, which of course means getting rid of a lot of vehicles, which is a scary proposition for the industry as well. But I'm starting to think we need more of these larger vehicles that a lot of people can take to the same destination to alleviate some of this traffic out there. And they could be self-driving and they could be electric. And so that's kind of where I
think you'll see it actually, and it'll all be done with pricing. So if you want to have your own car autonomous, let's say, that you call up on an app and it comes, you don't own it, let's say it just comes, and you don't want anybody else in the car, you're going to pay a higher amount of money for it. Whereas if you're able to split the ride with three or four other people, it's going to be a third to a quarter of the cost. And I think that's how it's going to get handled. I'm going to think, geez, I don't want to pay $25 for this ride. I want to pay $5 for this ride. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And, you know, Uber's already got that. They call it, I think it's Uber Pool. And if you're willing to ride along in a car with somebody else or a few other people, you know, it's a half, a third to a quarter the price to do so.
Yeah, okay, but so you can go to many airports in the United States right now and take a super shuttle from the airport to your hotel downtown, okay? And so you're in a van and you're sharing it with other people and you're paying a lower price by far. Mm-hmm. And if you take a cab. But the problem is that while you're all going in the general vicinity, you're not all going to the same place. So if you work for General Motors and you work for somebody else and I work for somebody else, but we all work downtown Detroit and we all live in the same proximity, you know, it sounds good except for the fact that it takes so bloody long time to get all the drop-offs before you get to where you're going to be going. Therefore, I don't see the incentive for somebody to say, gee, this is great. I can't wait to share the car because it'll just take me twice as long as
it might. But if you could think far ahead enough to realize, you know, all of it, well, it's partly slowed down because so many of us are in single occupant vehicles. That's one of the reasons that the bus is so slow to get downtown. If more people
if we were in the same car together, it would still take a long time for you to get dropped off, me to get dropped off, John to get dropped off.
I get that.
And Bill and Mary and whomever else.
But the difference, I think, could be, because your point's a good one, Gary, but the difference could be apps, where the app figures out, hey, you people, you're in such a close cluster, you know, it's going to be an extra 5 minutes. but now it's one-fifth the price.
Yeah.
And, you know, because people have said, you know, what's the big deal with Uber? We've had car sharing and carpooling forever. The difference is the app. It just makes it so much more convenient.
Mm-hmm.
And if you start applying that to Uber pooling, or let's just say it, car sharing pooling, the apps could make a real difference in mm-hmm. that. And again, then you're going to decide, you know what, the extra 5 minutes is too much. I don't want it. Mm-hmm. I want my own car back. But I think a lot of people are going to be, especially millennials, are going to be very open to this new way of getting around, especially if they can save a lot of money. And, you know, some of the money, the numbers that are being bandied out there is that an average household might be able to save as much as $5,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of households will go for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, John, I'm afraid a lot of your viewers are probably thinking, oh, my God, he's talking about abolishing vehicles and cars are going away. Or, I mean, cars that you can actually, you know, communicate with and drive yourself are going away. And because that's kind of the vision in some regards. But, you know, do you still see 10 years, 15 years from now, where we can still buy a car that we can drive ourselves?
Oh, I think it'll go beyond 2050.
Yeah, but remember, Bob Lutz told us that.
But Bob Lutz is wrong.
By 2030, you'll be able to buy your car, but you'll only be able to, like, drive it on private property. And you're not going to be able to drive it to the office. To the point of, I thought it was interesting about Proterra, and, you know, we're giving BMW big props for their iVentures putting. So I looked into that company. And
GM Ventures beat them there a couple of years ago, right?
Yep. And John Lochner, who is the chief technology officer of General Motors, is on their board. Mm-hmm. And another person who's on their board, which was a big surprise.
Al Gore.
Jennifer Granholm.
Oh, really?
Wow. Huh. Former governor of Michigan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And isn't Gore tied into that company
He's
as well?
He's tied in there somehow, yeah.
Yeah.
But so... Well, those are cool looking. I mean, they're made out of composites.
Oh, and, no. It's impressive. It's impressive.
You have like a party bus. You just go downtown. And
they're only $820,000 a piece, but they're cool buses.
Yeah.
Good miles per gallon.
So it's interesting. I was talking with, I don't know if I told you this story before, but Ian Robertson from BMW. I was asking him about, you know, how do you keep the brand alive when if all cars are the same and you're being driven somewhere, then why do you need to buy a BMW or a Porsche or... And he said, well, I believe that our brand is still going to be very important going forward, even in an era of self-driving cars. And he said that I live south of Munich about 45 minutes. I get in the car every morning and I drive to Munich. I get on the Autobahn, and I drive 240 kilometers per hour, you know, for about 30 minutes or so. And it's amazing. And I cherish that time every day. But then the last 10 minutes when I'm driving through Munich to get to the office, it's awful. And that's where I want to tune out. And I want to just hand off power to the car, and I want to do my email, I want to read the paper, I want to take a nap, whatever. And that's his vision of still allowing people to experience the glory of, you know, driving a car versus the less enjoyable parts of mobility. Getting through traffic and such.
Yeah, no, I think that's how it's going to go. You know, I think driving's going to be around for a long time to come. But I do believe there could be a point somewhere deep in the century where legislators say, you know, only humans get in accidents. No more human drivers.
All right, so here's a question. So if there's a whole bunch of millennials who are being driven around in these geofenced areas by autonomous vehicles, what's the likelihood that we're going to get to the point where people are not going to know how to drive?
Right.
It's going to be like manual transmissions, right?
Yeah. I mean, or even if you go back 100 years ago, I'm sure there was somebody saying, those kids in their horseless carriages, mm-hmm. they're never going to learn how to drive a team of horses.
And they didn't.
Right.
Or ride a horse.
Yeah.
That's true.
So soon we're going to, maybe faster than we think, we're going to have people who are no longer going to even...
They won't be skilled.
Won't have the skill.
Well, look, we're already down to a very lower percentage of teenagers with driver's licenses. You know, you go back 30 years ago, it was like 80, 90%. Now it's down in the 60, 70% range. Mm-hmm. So it's already started.
Right.
And the folks at the DMV are going to have to find new jobs.
That's right.
Yeah. Hmm. And with that, we have to wrap this show up. But Tom Murphy, thanks so much
for
coming by
me.
Today. Yeah,
thank you.
Really good.
Enjoyed it.
And it was great having Michael Levati here talking all about the Atlas. And Barry, you and I get to do this again.
We do. We do. Looking forward to it.
Okay. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, AutoLine.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.